Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air, and we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did, and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.
Loud and Local continues on The Rock with Kevin Deers, 99.9 KISW.
Hey, what's going on? Right now I'm talking with a guitarist for a band called Bitter End, Matt Fox, also from Zero Down. He was in Holy Terror, guitarist, longtime guitarist. They put out a record in 1990. That's 32 years ago. They put out a record called Harsh Realities. And on August 12th, M Theory is going to be reissuing this for anyone that was, you know, back in the day, they weren't able to get it on vinyl. Maybe their dog chewed it up, or maybe there's someone who's just getting into them now and they want a, you know, kind of a vision of what Seattle metal scene was like. So, you know, first off, welcome, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. We really appreciate it.
So where are you right now? Are you living in Seattle, or where are you living?
I live in fabulous Maple Leaf.
Okay. You
know, so kind of, I work in the U district, so yeah, a couple miles north of where I work. The rest of the band is sort of scattered afield. My brother Chris lives in Wichita now, is raising a family there, has been teaching college there for quite a while. He's a philosophy professor.
Okay.
Russ lives out in Roslyn, Cleellum, mm-hmm. and Harry is still holding things down in Linwood, running his business there.
Okay, right on, man. Well, you guys still stay in touch and hang out?
Well, me and my brother obviously do. Yeah. Don't talk to the other guys a lot. We've had occasion to, you know, we did reunion shows in 2012, 2016 with my brother living in Wichita. It's just not a thing that happens that much. Although he did pass through town last year. And at the last minute, I was doing a benefit show. I got to sit in with him for a couple tunes. We did some Sabbath stuff. Sabbath's fun.
Nice. Just
Chris is an amazing bass player. So anytime I get to sit in with my bro and play, it is a treat. And of course, anytime you get to play Black Sabbath, it's a treat too. So, but other than that, you know, we're grownups. We all have lives now. The other guys all have kids, mostly grown kids. My brother's got some little kids. So, you know, they keep busy.
How crazy is it that 32 years after the release of this record, it's coming out on vinyl and it's getting the nice vinyl treatment? Pretty wild to think, huh?
Yeah, it's great. It's interesting because my reference, you know, I've got copies of in every format, but my in America, Harsh Realities only came out on CD and cassette, if you remember what cassettes are.
I have quite a collection of cassettes.
But I have the Music for Nations vinyl pressing is sort of my reference, my good copy of Harsh Realities. I think the European distributor might have given it to me or something, but it wasn't available in America on vinyl, so that's kind of a new thing.
Yeah,
and it is getting harder to, you know, I think we sold somewhere around 10,000 copies of it, which is, you know, was respectable at the time. I think
these days that would be astronomical.
Yeah, well, but then after that, you know, 1992, I think the bar was raised a little higher for what good record sales were.
For sure.
People started to sell a few more records around here.
Especially Seattle. Yeah.
Just a few. But it, you know, it did pretty well for the kind of record it was. It is still, I see people asking reasonable amounts for it on eBay, which always entertains me. But I think it's great that people have an opportunity to, you know, get a copy on vinyl. I think it's going to be like nuclear green vinyl, and they've done a really nice job packaging it.
Yeah.
And what was really cool is, so, you know, Marco Barbieri is the guy from M Theory Audio who contacted us about doing a reissue. He was someone I knew because he used to write zines back in the day. So even when before we were on Metal Blade, you know, we did the whole sending out, the Meet Your Maker demo. Mm-hmm. We did an independently produced demo before we got our deal. And, you know, I was doing the whole tape trading, hustling thing. So Marco is someone I knew from then who contacted us out of the blue saying, you know, I've been talking to Metal Blade. They're willing to reissue it. And I was really pleasantly surprised that he was able to make that deal happen. I think that's great. It's been out of print, you know, since 1990. So who are we to say no, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So was it kind of out of nowhere that you felt like this correspondence with Marco, for, you know, were you surprised at all?
I was rather surprised. You know, we had done someone a few years back, and I should be remembering who, a label reissued. So we had a bunch of stuff. It's kind of complicated. So the Metal Blade deal happened. At the time, our A&R rep, Diana Cass, moved over to Combat Records.
Okay.
Who were pretty happy and I think pushed bands maybe a little harder than Metal Blade. So we had a thought that, well, let's try and get another deal, right? So we recorded a bunch of stuff that never came out. And sometime back, I should know this and I don't, I was contacted by a small label that put out the Have a Nice Death thing, which was a reissue of the Meet Your Maker demo and a bunch of the unreleased later stuff that never came out that was after Harsh Realities.
Okay.
So that's out there. You can find it. It's Have a Nice Death.
Yeah.
And I'm old and senile and I can't remember the name of the label that put it out, but it's out there. You can find it.
Yeah.
So that was cool. But, you know, yeah, to have someone just come out of the blue from, you know, 30 years ago, who was a zine guy who has, you know, since gone on to do a lot of industry stuff. I think he worked for Century Rec, mm-hmm. Century Media maybe for a while or something like that.
They have a lot of good releases coming out.
Yeah. So we were like, oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Please put it out. Yes.
That's awesome.
So everyone's pretty excited about it. You know, it's, you know, I mean, we're not all going to quit our day jobs over it, but it's just nice to know that people have access to a cool old record and that, you know, it'll be out again. I think that's a great thing.
So, with, you know, with this being out in the world now, you know, any chance of another reunion?
Possibly, you know, with my brother's schedule, it's just hard. Well, the other thing is Russ just had old guy stuff. Sorry, old guy stuff.
No worries.
I forget myself. He had major shoulder surgery, so I don't think he'll be playing for a while. So I don't know if we'll be able to do anything this year to coincide with the release because of that. I mean, I think he had like a full reconstruction of his shoulder and all that kind of stuff. But that doesn't mean that down the road, we might not do it again. It's just kind of hard to make the schedules all mesh. My brother and his wife teach. So they sort of do this thing where when school's over, she's from Malaysia. In fact, they're in Malaysia and then they'll be in Hong Kong and then I'll see him briefly this summer when he passes through town. So mm-hmm. Their schedule's kind of complicated and all that. So probably won't happen this year, but definitely is a thing that could happen again in the future.
Awesome, man. Well, so I'm curious, you know, like, so this is kind of a time capsule. So let's go back in time, 1990, Seattle metal scene. You know, what was the lay of the land, man? What were the venues you were playing? Was it the Off Ramp? You know, was it the Velvet Elvis? What were these places?
Velvet Elvis, not really so much. So
okay.
I've been asked to participate in this photo project and I'm thinking about this stuff. So I turned 21 in 1987.
Okay.
And the first venues that Bitter End was playing at that point, before that, it was really like independently produced hall shows at places like the Ballard VFW Hall.
Yep.
And the Clearview Grange Hall and the Renton Musicians Hall. And then sort of my whole age.
And over in Bellevue at the skate rink, right?
A little before my time. That was, that's a little before I started doing shows. That would be Lake Hills. A lot of stuff went down. We moved back up here in 83 and Lake Hills sort of, me and my brother lived in Southern California for a time and moved back up in 83, my senior year. And I think Lake Hills was just sort of going away 84-ish.
Okay.
I went to shows at Gorilla Gardens, Rock Theater, Community World Theater in Tacoma was a place we played a lot. That was an all ages kind of venue. And then my sort of whole age cohort all turned 21. So we all started, and all of a sudden, which, you know, back then there was a teen dance hall ordinance. So it was hard to do all ages gigs, particularly in the city limits. So a lot of that stuff occurred in more suburban places, you know, like Snohomish or Linwood. Linwood Rollaway was a place, you know, people played. I don't think we did.
Bremerton had Natasha's, right?
Natasha's lasted for a while too. Natasha was in Bremerton. We played, we actually played there. Oh, might have been in 90, maybe with Sacred Reich, but my brain is blurry now.
Yeah.
But yeah, so locally when everyone turned 21, we all mostly were playing the Central and the Vogue, right? We're really the big places for heavy rock bands.
Yeah.
To an extent, Meekers had Meeker Mondays down in Kent. I believe I saw Metal Church down there, played there a bunch of times.
Yeah.
I think we played with Heathen there maybe.
Okay.
So there were a lot of sort of venues. And then the Off-Ramp is a little more of a, I want to say more of a 91, 92 kind of thing.
Okay.
And then Rock Candy opened. So the way it worked back then, you had the clubs with beer, and then there was the bar next door with hard liquor. This is before everywhere had hard liquor. Most places didn't have hard liquor then. Mm-hmm. So you always had the 1-2 punch. Like it was the Vogue and the Frontier Room. You drink beer at the Vogue and maybe smoke a little weed at the Vogue because they there put up with that there. And then you'd go over to the Frontier Room and Nina would pour you a deadly stiff drink. And then you would sort of float back and forth between them. Rock Candy, Off Ramp were sort of neighboring clubs. So it was sort of a lot of the twofer thing. Definitely by 91, 92, the Off Ramp was effectively my living room.
Wow.
I spent a whole lot of time in Rock Candy and all those places.
Yeah.
Weathered Wall, I guess, was a place that had a lot of shows. Squid Row was a little more punk. And then there was the whole Lake Union punk scene, the Lake Union pub and the Storeroom, which I went to, but we didn't play as much because we were a little more metal.
Yeah.
And all through this, there were still sort of independently produced shows around. So there were still the occasional hall shows and stuff. But once everyone turned 21, we were able to get into clubs. So we started booking shows in clubs more.
Nice. Right on, man. Okay. So, you put out this demo and then you get signed to Metal Blade. How did you guys get on the radar of Metal Blade? Because, there were other bands like Panic was on Metal Blade, right?
Panic were signed after we were. So,
okay.
So 89, and I'm trying to remember how. So we were playing at the Riviera in Lynwood.
Okay.
Which was, we opened for Scatterbrain. If you remember Scatterbrain, Don't Call Me Dude.
I don't.
One of their first shows in Seattle was at the Riviera. And they, at the time, this is before they broke big, and they were kind of mortified that they were playing a heavy metal steakhouse in Lynwood, Washington.
That's funny.
Yeah. So Diana Cass from Metal Blade, I think maybe Jeff Gilbert invited her out.
Oh, awesome.
Came and
shout out Jeff Gilbert, classic brain pain on KCMU. Brain pain,
Jeff Gilbert.
Yeah.
And we used to, well, this is an aside, but we used to every Sunday at what was called the House of Death in the U District, we had brain pain parties for years with like 40 people every Sunday in my house.
Herb from Drawn and Quarter told me about those.
Yeah, it's kind of legendary. If you remember it, you probably weren't there. that sort of thing. It was a little decadent. So Jeff, I think, invited Diana Cash. She was in town. Maybe we booked the gig there because we knew she'd be in town. She had maybe, I think, gotten a copy of the Meet Your Maker demo. And then we did a demo for Metal Blade before Harsh Realities. We demoed those songs with Jack and Dino, a lot of stuff on the record.
Nice.
So Diana got us the deal. So we're probably the only band to ever get a record deal from playing at the Riviera in Lynwood.
Okay, nice. Shout out Riviera in Lynwood.
I don't know what it is now. It may or may not still be there. It was like at 196th and 48th or some. It was definitely in the depths of Lynwood. Deep Lynwood.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So we got the deal. Panic, I think, didn't get signed until maybe 91, 92. They were a little later. I think at that point, Sanctuary were the signed metal band in town.
Yeah.
And they started doing quite well. They got the attention of Dave Mustaine, who did a lot for them. February of 1990, we go to LA. Before then, Randy Burns, our A&R rep, Diana Cass, knew Randy Burns, who had produced Peace Sells and like Creator and
Death,
a bunch of stuff.
Possessed. Yeah.
Possessed, a whole bunch
Nuclear
of stuff.
Assault. Yeah.
So this would be somewhere around, I guess he came up around in fall of 89. And he actually stayed at the House of Death and did pre-production with us for a week and like stayed in our horrible party house basement.
Wow.
and showed and worked with us through rehearsals, and we kind of tightened up arrangements, and he added some vocal parts, and he suggested the kind of stuff that happens in pre-production where you learn that you have to track everything without solos, and then you're going to go fly them in later, and it's just a whole different way of approaching your stuff if you're a live band like we were.
But he lived the dirtbag life with you for a week.
Yeah, and he was an older guy, so in retrospect I really appreciate that, because
he had to know the vibe. He had to find out what the vibe was like, dude. He had
to also, he had gotten sober at that point, so I'm sure we were a little challenging.
Oh, okay. Yes.
He came up, did pre-production with us, found a studio in LA that was like the cheapest studio you could get Lockout in, that had a full-on 2-inch Studer deck and a Neve board, which is the great, the classic Neve board. I am told that the recording console that we worked on, actually Jeff Beck recorded there and back on, I guess. Wow. So I was like thrilled, right?
That's awesome.
So we go to LA, spend, whatever it is, a week and a half recording. They had never seen a band drink that much coffee before. We were pretty good about not partying while we were working.
The Seattle band, you got to have a gimmick.
We drank coffee's your gimmick. And this is before Starbucks had taken over the universe, right?
So yes.
What's with all the coffee, right? And which is also why the tempos on the record are probably a little pushed, I think.
There you go. There you go.
But so we had a lot of fun making the record down there. It was a pretty amazing experience. Yeah, I was 22 or 23 or whatever I was, 23, I guess.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, a heck of a good time. I learned a lot from Randy. This is back before they had automation. So like on the final mix, you'd have a 24-channel board in front of you and you would sit there and like everyone would be writing mutes on. So like the drum intro, you got 20 hands on mutes. And then when everything comes in, you, and then you're sitting there and go, and at this point, okay, we got to push this fader right there for that little guitar part. And this is all happening in real time. This is all automated now. Right.
Yeah.
But this is the old Stone Age method of recording where it was all really in real time. And I definitely learned a heck of a lot from Randy and I'm still very grateful to him for what he did for us and the stuff I learned.
Awesome, man. Well, okay. So, you know, the album's released, you know, you get a music video on Headbangers Ball. What was that like? Must've been a pretty surreal thing watching your music video on Headbangers Ball.
Yeah. I think it only aired a couple times. We were pretty minor band. There were still a lot of major bands out there. I think we sort of had to lean on Metal Blade to do a video.
Okay.
And we shot that video at the, they finally tore it down, but it was what was called Crown Studios, which was right off the West Seattle Bridge. And if you look the video up, it's interesting because you could see Port of Seattle trains going behind us and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. That is now a giant active space building. When you come off the West Seattle Bridge and go toward Alki, we were rehearsing there up until several years ago. Zero Down and had a room there. Heartwood, my sort of fun country band thing I did with Russ, we had a room there right up until the last moment. And it was such a great rehearsal space.
It was
totally a hang and a party and cheap.
Yeah.
Which does not exist anymore in Seattle.
Yep.
So that building's gone now, but we shot it there. A guy named Tom Ensign did the video. And I think you still find the video on like YouTube and stuff. It's out there. Nice. And you can see what we look like when we were young and skinny and cute and all that, because we're old men now.
But you still got your hair. That's more than I can say.
Most of it. I'm at 55. I'm grateful for any hair that's still on my head.
There you go.
You know, so it goes, right? So we did the video. It didn't get a lot of play. I think it got more play on kind of specialized local shows, which is probably for the kind of band we were, which was really fine. You know, MTV play would have been great. We would have been bigger, but it was still cool because I think if you had a regional video show like Bomb Shelter here, you know, it got played on a lot of sort of regional shows that I probably never even really knew about, I think. But yeah, it was cool. I mean, we didn't get enough tours. We got to tour with DRI for a while. That was fun.
Yeah. Those guys would probably be fun to party with.
They were super nice guys. They were, it was interesting time. They were getting a little bit of a backlash for going metal with their
old crossover.
Yeah. But the shows were wild. I mean, we definitely saw some crazy stuff at those shows.
I bet.
There was a guy, I hope he's all right, but you know, like fell off a third floor balcony at Kiguanas in Tijuana, you know, like all kinds of just wild stuff.
Yeah.
And that was a super fun tour. And then we toured with Sacred Reich briefly and that was super great. They're great guys. They were doing the American Way record, which is, you know, at the time I liked more than Injustice for All. I thought it was a better record.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
I mean, that good a record. To me, I put that record on, it still holds up. Rest in peace, Jason Rainey, their original rhythm guitar player, is no longer with us and passed on last year or year before or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so we had some, you know, not huge tours, but good tours. And we got a lot of good shows in town, opened for a lot of great bands, had a, you know, a really good time. So it's all a very pleasant memory for sure. It was a hell of a way to spend my early 20s.
So back in that time, you know, Metal Shop was going. Was it Kathy Faulkner was the host of Metal Shop? Do you remember?
I believe so, yeah.
Did you guys ever get played on Metal Shop? Did you ever hang out with Kathy?
Local radio was pretty kind to us. Awesome. We might even predate Metal Shop, though. I think maybe Metal Shop might be
Steve Slayton was.
Yeah. It might have been Slayton, yeah. You might be right. And, you know, this is what happens when you get old and have other things happen in the intervening 30 years. If my brother were doing this interview, he remembers everything that ever happened. He's like the family memory. I'm the guy who lives in a pleasant blur. But yeah, Metal Shop, I think Metal Shop might be later. That might be more toward the end of the run on Bitter End. Maybe more like 91, 92. I could be picked up in mid 92.
Okay.
Thereabouts. I had joined Dr. Unknown and was playing in two bands, and Dr. Unknown was happening. And, you know, me and Chris had been doing Bitter End at that point since like 1985 with Harry. And it was, you know, it just felt like the world was changing. His taste more than mine was changing. And I think we just looked at each other one day at rehearsal and said, you know, it's been fun, you know, and it was just one of those things. It was organic. It was fine. You know, I don't think it was a traumatic. It wasn't like there was an incident. It was just, you know, the world was moving on. We were getting older. We had been doing it a while. I think Chris was interested in, he wound up playing on Jeff Tate from Queensryche's solo record some years after that, which is a whole other complicated story that comes out of the Dr. Unknown Dinsdale days. When Jeff Tate managed the band Dinsdale, I was in with Jeff Carroll. Tried to get us a deal. Didn't happen. So he just grabbed Jeff and half of our songs and made a solo record, which was awesome because I'm like, good. Go make a record with Jeff Tate.
There you go.
And then my brother wound up playing on that record and touring with those guys. So
nice.
So yeah, we've all done, you know, this and that. I've had a lot of fun playing it. I was like the founding bass player of Rockaroki. So I learned how to play bass in what was like my only top 40 experience, which is where I would go out and grind it out for 3-4 hours a night for a living. Sure. But it was learning how to play bass, and it was a lot of fun for a while. That one was fun till it wasn't. Another thing, you know, it's like, I guess for me, it's like, I love playing music and I still love playing music. COVID kind of put a little bit of a damper on that. I still get occasional gigs, but it's been slow since COVID, but
sure.
You know, I want to do what I want to do. And if I don't like what I'm doing, it's not what I want to do. So
we look at the timeline of Bitter End, and it looks as though if I were to like make a picture in my head of just not talking to you, but just looking at it on paper, I would say grunge killed Bitter End, but that's not the truth.
It's, you know, you could look at it and say that. I think in a way, like my brother was looking at bands like Living Color, right? Which is more of an 80s band, but, you know, he wanted to do more of a kaleidoscopic, really full range kind of thing because he's that kind of musician.
Yeah.
I don't think it certainly didn't help us get a second deal. You know, I mean, you know, shopping for a metal band to get a deal, we were sort of right in between, right? I mean, some years after that, all of a sudden metal bands, you know, was it rock and roll? They aren't Super Suckers. They aren't playing rock and roll records this year or whatever.
Because you're a Seattle band, but you're not that kind of Seattle band, right?
And it wasn't what labels were looking for.
Yeah.
Dr. Unknown just sort of missed the boat on that one. Mm-hmm. We were competing for a deal the same time as Candlebox, and they got the deal instead of us. Oh, well, so it goes. Good for you guys. But yeah, that was one of the things. And I think, you know, I think Chris was getting a little out of the metal thing. We had sort of started to the later Bitter End stuff. So if you go backwards, so 85, 86, 87 even, we woodshedded for a long time. And I wrote a lot of really complicated music that was impossible to sing over.
Okay. Which,
because I was not the singer at that point. I didn't quite realize.
Yeah.
And we tried out a lot of people who couldn't sing. This is back when you would advertise in the Rocket.
Shout out to the Rocket.
You know, there'd be like a musicians wanted section, and the flakiest, most non-performing people tended to be lead singers.
Okay.
So you'd get a lot of guys that'd say
still the same way. Yeah.
Would show up and then not sing at rehearsal. Oh no, my voice is stored today, you know, and then it'd string you along for 2 months. You'd finally get out of my,
band. I don't carry gear.
Make a note of that time marker. You can delete that.
I'll be listening to the whole thing. So
I can't help myself sometimes. So I wound up having to sing. And in the course of learning to sing, I learned that you need to do things like leave room for vocals and songs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, the music sort of changed in Bitter End. We were still very riffy, very technical, but there would be spaces where you could sing a little more. And that's just a thing I learned, you know, and is a thing I'm still learning because it's, you know, songwriting getting good at it is a lifelong process unless you're a genius, which most people aren't.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had moved into a direction that was a little more slower. Dare I say one of the songs, Sludge off of what became Have a Nice Death. It was maybe a little Sabbath-y and grungy. But, you know, the world had changed a little bit. We had changed. I don't think it helped. I mean, I think, in terms of trying to find a follow-up after we left Metal Blade, definitely not the best timing for us.
What was that like being in Seattle and being this band, you know, that, you know, had been going for quite a while now. And then all of a sudden, all eyes are on Seattle, you know, A&R's descending upon Seattle. Was that a pretty surreal moment?
It was weird. See, the thing for me was I joined Doctor Unknown in February of 92.
Okay.
And we were sort of in that. Like, yeah. Doctor Unknown, we had Jeff Carroll, who was an amazing singer. And the kind of singer you get on the radio. And I am not really a radio style singer.
Sure.
You know, except for Metal Shop maybe. But you know what I'm saying? Like mainstream.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I know.
It's
yeah,
a different
yeah, yeah.
kind of singing. And so it was a lot of fun to play with Jeff. And also it was Derek and Ray, who'd been an heir apparent. Great mm-hmm. rhythm section.
Yes.
And, you know, we were definitely firing on all cylinders there and getting a lot of label interest. We got a publishing deal with PolyGram. So I got a taste of it. It just didn't happen.
Sure.
And that, you know, might be part of Bitter End. You know, it was fun not to have, because Bitter End was kind of my, you know, really, I was the motivated driving force of that band. I wanted it, right? So I was working my ass off doing hustling, promoting, being the band leader, being the guy who was pushing everyone to do this, that, and the other thing. Which I think also is, you know, made probably people think I was bossy and annoying, which sure. probably sure. I was at okay. 23.
You know, you said it. You learn. You said it. Yeah.
You learn. It's okay. You know.
Yeah.
I was, you know, young and testosterone-y. Now I'm old and semi-testosterone-y. life goes on. So you know, things were changing. But it was interesting to see. You know, the thing is, really, 94, I guess, is the year right where it just went absolutely berserk. Because you had Soundgarden 1990 or so, 89 with Loud Love being pretty big, right?
Yeah.
I was actually, at the time I wrote for Backlash magazine, and Don, this is not the stranger, Don had really strict ethics about what I was allowed to write about. So I wrote about kind of the hard rock glammy scene.
Okay.
And I was the first person in town to write about Alice in Chains.
Wow.
Who were great.
Yeah.
And I was buddies with, and I was going to a lot of their shows and hanging out a lot with them. Jerry didn't have a car. I had a car. So me and Jerry used to go flyering. We drive around and put up flyers for our respective bands. So I was definitely hanging with a lot of those bands and it was a lot of fun, but that's, you know, that's still almost more like conventional hard rock as opposed to grunge at that point. It's a little more Guns N' Roses you've seen maybe. But we played a lot of mixed bills with a lot of those bands.
Yeah.
Back then they did not stratify bands so much by what your genre was. So there was a lot more crossover bills then, which was great and a lot of fun. But it was, you know, come 94. Yeah. That's really where
the feeding frenzy.
It all really hit the fan. And you know, it was pretty amazing to watch, you know, that's, you know, I stopped seeing Alice cause you know, they were like, you know, living in tour buses and being rock stars and stuff, you know, so good for them.
Absolutely. So again, what we're talking about is Bitter End and the re-release of Harsh Realities on vinyl. Finally, after 32 years, you can pick it up on vinyl through M3 Audio. Going to be released on August 12th. So, you know, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me today, Matt. And for Metal Shop and for the for Loud and Local and for the whole, you know, KISW local community and for Seattle, do you have any final words, you know, before we go out there and we pick up this record?
You know, thanks so much for all the support that, you know, Bitter End and all the bands I've ever been involved with have gotten, both from KISW, because KISW has definitely, for a station sort of its mainstream size and weight, really has been supportive of local bands for a long time. And that is awesome. And I love that KISW still does that. Rock is not dead, kids. I mean, you know, it may not get the attention in mainstream media that other genres do, but there's still a lot of dedicated people plugging away. I love that Rock Band has created a generation of like 13-year-old kids who are out there really cranking it out and trying to learn how to play the classic stuff in the classic way where you play in real time and it's not all pieced together where, okay, here's boom, tap,
exactly.
Sequence it out and then, you know, cut and paste everything. There's really the whole school of rock thing is just really great. And again, thanks to KSW and to Seattle. And I, you know, thanks to clubs like Slim's and Daryl's where they let old men like me play still and we can hang out still. So that's a great thing. I think, you know, I went to New York City a couple years ago. I could not find live rock and roll in New York City to save my life. Biggest city in America. No rock, none. And, you know, you go to Seattle and we have on any given weekend, you know, COVID kind of put an end to it for a while, but now that, you know, we're coming out of that, any given weekend, there are 5-10 great shows going on. And that is a really amazing thing to have been and occasionally still able to be a part of. And for that, I am very grateful. It's a lot of fun.
it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly you know what why people it's not, outside of Cleveland you know, think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone. I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air. And we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome, man. Well, dude, thank you so much. We're going to jam a song from this record. That's actually the title track, Harsh Realities. And dude, thank you so much for taking the time. Pick up this vinyl on M Theory, and hopefully I'll be seeing you around.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air, and we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did, and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.